regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Colton Grob. I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. If you'd like to learn more about each of our speakers and their work, you can visit regproject.org, where we have their full bios. After opening remarks and discussion between our panelists, we will go to audience Q&A. So please be thinking of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. This afternoon, we're pleased to host a conversation exploring whether and how a Biden administration might approach the regulations that were temporarily waived by the Trump administration at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our moderator for today's discussion is Daniel Flores, the chief counsel for the House of Representatives Subcommittee on Regulatory Reform, Commercial and Antitrust Law for the Committee on the Judiciary. Daniel, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Colton. As we all know, the COVID-19 pandemic and our responses to it have turned a great many patterns of ordinary life upside down. Some of those patterns will return to the normal we once knew when the pandemic finally subsides, but others may never return. Most everyone knows the most obvious impacts the pandemic has had on our lives. Many thousands of our loved ones have been lost. Millions upon millions of us have not physically been to work or school since lockdowns began. Countless businesses, especially small businesses, have gone under or have survived so far only because of emergency government aid. The trajectories of the lives of many of those small businesses' owners and workers has been changed forever. Among the less well-known impacts of the pandemic response has been its impact upon regulation and regulatory enforcement, especially because of the dire straits in which many small businesses have been caught since lockdowns began. Government has recognized the need for a more flexible approach to regulation and regulatory enforcement during the pandemic period. One NGO has estimated that the Trump administration has suspended or waived over 800 regulations since the pandemic began. These regulations have concerned a slew of activities, from telemedicine to production of sanitizer at distilleries, to the push for seeking approval of new therapeutics, to hours of rules for commercial vehicle drivers, transporting emergency relief, and the list goes on extensively. With the pandemic expected to continue well into 2021, as we look towards the next presidential term, the question arises, what might a Biden administration do regarding regulatory waivers and suspensions? Here to discuss this important topic today are Karen Harned, Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Business Small Business Legal Center, and Sally Katzen, Professor of Practice and Distinguished Scholar in Residence at the New York University School of Law, co-director of NYU's Legislative and Regulatory Process Clinic, and former administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs for President Clinton. Karen and Sally both have been immersed for decades in the key regulatory policy issues of our time in these and other roles. I'm Daniel Flores, your moderator today, as Colton mentioned. I actually serve now as senior counsel on the Committee on Oversight and Reform of the House of Representatives. Prior to that, I was in the position he mentioned on the House Judiciary Committee, and before that at the EPA's Office of General Counsel and the Department of Justice's Environment and Natural Resources Division. Like Karen and Sally, I too have been active in many of the key regulatory policy debates of the past couple of decades. Let me just note I'm here in my personal capacity, not in, on behalf of Ranking Member Comer or anybody else associated with the committee or the House. With that introduction, let me turn it over to our panelists. Karen, let's start with you.
Great. Thanks for having me, everyone. And thank you for moderating, Daniel. And it's always good to be with you, Sally. So it has the pandemic has really shown, I think, in a bigger picture, you know, the best and maybe, you know, in some respects, the worst of government. And as we look back on it, one of the things that and what we're talking about today is it really did give us in real time information on where regulations are providing speed bumps when the government needs to be nimble to deal with a crisis. In this instance, of course, it's a public health emergency dealing with a pandemic. So I would recommend to those that are interested in this, both the Americans for Tax Reform and the Americans for the American Action Forum have tracked these waivers, but there have been, since the beginning of the pandemic, a number of regulatory waivers that were deemed necessary by the administration in order to address the issues that kept presenting. And as you will see, you know, I'm going to just run through some highlights. According to ATR, there's 846 now waivers. I think that also includes states, but regardless, we're in the hundreds. So we're definitely not going to be covering all those today. But the majority, as you would imagine, are in the health space and primarily with FDA, HHS, and CMS, the Centers for Medical Services, or I think that's what it's called. But anyway, the people that do Medicare and all of that is a CMS component of HHS. But FDA moved rather quickly because, as we all remember, you couldn't find a test to save your life when you're trying to save your life and find out if you have COVID. And so they removed several restrictions, giving states new powers to authorize labs in their states to do these tests, to also distribute the tests. They gave emergency use authorization for devices used in diagnostic testing for COVID. They also did a lot of work on telemedicine. And I think as we discuss lessons learned from this moving forward, I mean, I would definitely put telemedicine in the, you know, a thumbs up category here, because there were apparently a lot of things that made that more problematic than maybe it needed to be prior to COVID. Right now we're operating under waivers of HIPAA so that your care provider can use Google or other of those types of platforms if they need to see you physically. Were a lot of restrictions, not just for telemedicine, but also for the practice of medicine. As we remember, you know, New York was such a hotspot and at the very beginning of this, that would permit, you know, physicians and other healthcare professionals, nurses, to practice out of state. So we have many that traveled to New York, for example, at the early times to treat patients there, but restrictions had to be lifted for that to not be an illegal activity. Let's see, there were more services that could be provided under telehealth as a result of restrictions being lifted. We remember, and then there were on the CMS side, so the Center for that deals with Medicare, allowing for ambulances to transport patients to a wide range of locations when other transportation was not medically appropriate, including physicians' offices, mental health centers, allowing non-physician practitioners to do more, like ordering tests and medicines for patients. Eliminated some paperwork so that they were having more time to see patients in their practices. And then you had, you know, again, when we're dealing with the shortage of supplies, remembering you couldn't find toilet paper or hand sanitizer to save your life. Well, the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau had to lift restrictions to allow distilled spirits producers permission to produce a hand sanitizer. DOT waived hours of service requirements for certain truckers to allow for greater flexibility. This was limited to the truckers transporting medical supplies, testing equipment, hand sanitizer, disinfectants, and foods required for emergency restocking. Then EPA and other agencies, I remember I have a good friend that does OSHA work, you know, they were scheduled for some, you know, annual tests that they had to have done by an OSHA inspector, but it was just, you know, basically like your, I don't know if I'd call it a physical, but it was not something that was inherent to, you know, a problem that was happening at that plant at that time. And, you know, you didn't have OSHA inspectors that wanted to go in because of COVID concerns that they had. And so, and I don't even know how many of those inspectors and other inspectors, honestly, were going to facilities in real time at that point. And my point is, then you can't meet that requirement if you don't have anybody that comes in and does it when you're relying on a government inspector to do something. So there were certain waivers, I think, of those types of requirements if the business could explain why and not that they were just blowing it off, say we were due for this test, but nobody was available, so therefore we didn't do it or whatever. But all that to say, and then generally there in May, as we were starting to think that we might get to come back to work, which I guess, you know, for some it did happen, the president issued an executive order that really was meant to ensure that there was nothing that was in the regulation space that's inhibiting the economic recovery. And in particular, you know, as a longtime representative of small businesses, I liked the shout out to my constituency, which was really, if you look at what the executive order said, it was basically putting on paper, let's not do gotcha, you know, enforcement here. I mean, if you see an issue at a business, then by all means address it with the business owner, but we don't need to throw the book at them the first time that they move forward. And then I think, you know, like with CMS, there was some paperwork requirement restrictions that were waived. I don't know how much more of that was happening more broadly, but of course, you know, the other thing that this May executive order did was really ask agencies moving forward how they can help, you know, lead to the economic recovery and not be a hindrance to it. And for small businesses, paperwork burden has always been the number one regulatory burden they face. And as we are trying to come out of this pandemic, this is something that I think a lot of agencies need to think about. You know, if they still need the information, does the form need to be 5 pages long, or could it maybe be, you know, a check the box 1-page deal? And I think that, you know, that directive is still in force. And I think, and I'm hopeful that the agencies are going back and looking and seeing, do we really need to do this or that, or make it this complicated? I mean, this, I think, pandemic's bottom line, I guess, my, to summarize my comments is, you know, on the goods, this really showed a light on regulation and, you know, honestly, how it can be a hindrance and to a nimble government. And I think as we come out of this, we need to come out of it thoughtfully and not just slap back on all the regulatory and paperwork requirements that were there, you know, without any thought. Maybe this is a time to go back through, and I know the president's directed this, and say, do all these requirements need to go back in toto the way they were? I would suggest probably not. And I know that bureaucrats are busy, but I also think that it is important for us to clean house. And we've had an opportunity where there was dramatic house cleaning, and rather than just throw all the dirt back on the floor, maybe we go in and do spot checks and figure out where we need to go in and fix things moving forward by reinstating a regulation, but where maybe one doesn't need to be reinstated, or maybe that form could be significantly simplified. And with that, those are my comments.
This is Sally Katzen, and I think I'm next, and I want to start by thanking you for inviting me and to join some of my favorite colleagues on this panel. Then I would like disclaimers. I do wear a D jersey, and I did some policy work for the Biden campaign, but I am not on the transition. And I threw away my crystal ball in 2016 when Trump beat Clinton. But with those caveats, my best answer to the question in the title for today's discussion, what might a Biden administration do? My best answer, who knows? Surely Karen's thoughts are as sound as mine. But that being said, I have a few random or not so random thoughts that I've been encouraged by FedSoc to share with you. First, I believe that the often repeated justification for the Trump administration's regulatory waivers and suspensions, namely the continued adherence and or enforcement of those regulations, would cut against, if not destroy, the economy's ability to recover from this pandemic, is somewhat disingenuous, if not pretextual, to borrow a phrase from Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the census case. This administration took as its mission the, quote, deconstruction of the administrative state, close quote. And Trump, as a candidate, vowed to reduce by as much as 75% the regulations on the books. His first executive order on the subject called for 2-for-1. For every new regulation, the agency had to rescind 2 existing regulations of comparable cost to the new one. And I, for one, will not forget his photo op at a White House briefing featuring his cutting a big, broad red tape and touting the number of regulations he had already gotten rid of and proudly promising that this was just the beginning. And this was well before COVID and its horrible consequences, not only on the health of the nation, but on its economy. So the let's not regulate or let's not enforce regulations on the books is not new. There's another recurring theme present in this mix that is also not new and not COVID related. And that is the focus on costs and burdens of regulations without any mention, let alone consideration of benefits. Again, this emphasis has been present from the beginning of this administration and flows through, I might say, infects every description of the need for and is the justification of waivers and suspensions of regulation. Again, President Trump's executive order for the 2-for-1 regime, he mentioned the costs of regulations 17 times. He never said the word benefit. His repeated press statements claiming credit for reducing the regulatory burden always talked in terms of costs. He never talked in terms of benefits, let alone foregone benefits from either not enforcing or rescinding or suspending existing regs. And Karen talked about some of the costs or burdens of regulations. And again, I didn't hear anything about foregone benefits. And Daniel is with the House committee, although he's here in his personal capacity, they have a bill that would authorize continued waiver and suspension of regulations in light of COVID. It also speaks of costs and burdens and doesn't mention benefits. This is not new. This is not COVID related. This is simply an extension of a governing philosophy. So I may be old-fashioned, but I was schooled in cost-benefit analysis. That was the heart or guts of President Reagan's executive order. And the underpinnings of centralized review by OIRA for every president since, almost 40 years now, both Democrats and Republicans. In fact, for the last 15 to 20 years, some even say benefit-cost analysis to emphasize benefit factors in the equation. Do the benefits outweigh or justify the costs? So to strip away any consideration of benefits and to speak only of costs is, I believe, a gross distortion of economic principles as well as common sense. As I've said, this is not new. This is not COVID related. And I think it taints the whole exercise we're undertaking. One more point on this piece of the discussion. We are told by those who support continuation of regulatory waivers or suspensions that such action is imperative to get the economy up and running again. The premise here is that regulations are a drag on the economy. They are keeping us back and cannot coexist with a healthy, vibrant, growing economy. I would submit that that is not the case. The booming economy during the first 3 years of Trump was the same or less booming than during the last 3 years of the Obama administration by any number of indices. And I would wager that few would dispute the fact that during those last 3 years of Obama, we saw a lot of regulations being issued and taking effect. Yet the economy thrived. So the faith in deregulation as contributing to economic growth, and that is the means to the end, the deregulation leads to a vibrant, growing economy, may be more of a slogan or talking point than a conclusion based on facts. This leads to my next, and I think most important point. I believe it's a fallacy to speak in terms of regulations writ large, as if all regulations are the same, deserving of the same treatment, subject to the same command, continue being waived or suspended, or not. Now, I often ask my students whether we should do X or Y. The best answer often is, it depends. So too here. I cannot say that the regs that have been waived or suspended should continue in that status, at least until the pandemic is over and maybe for a period of time thereafter. I cannot say that the regs that have been waived or suspended should spring back in effect on January 20th or shortly thereafter. Not all regulations are alike, and their waiver or suspension or their reimposition and enforcement cannot, or at least I think should not, be treated the same. One size doesn't fit all. Not all regs are bad, not all regs are good. And I think it's better to treat each on its own merits. So for example, I would fully support continuing the availability to conduct telemedicine across state lines, but I would emphatically resist the relaxation of the hours of service rule. The first was one of many precautionary rules adopted in another time concerning the practice of medicine. Among others, it was a reflection of deference to state primacy in licensing and terms of practice, something similar to the provisions for the practice of law with which most of you are familiar. Each state has its own standard for licensing and admission to the courts of its jurisdiction, a form of federalism, something democratic as well as Republicans value in our federal society. Now, should it be flexible in times of a pandemic? I'm glad it was, living in the District of Columbia and having doctors in adjoining states. And what did we learn? The restriction was lifted for COVID and the sky did not fall in. So far as I am aware, the suspension of that rule and many of the others that Karen has talked about from CMS and FDA did not result in any harm and provided strong benefits, affording competent health care without requiring people to leave their homes. Should the suspension of those throughout the pandemic, and more importantly for today's discussion, afterwards or permanently? I'm inclined to say yes. I would join Karen on that, but I would add that that decision should be based on something more than my instincts or preferences, rather on an expedited review of the facts. the actual consequences, both the good and the bad, of the results of the suspension. What actually, not theoretically or anecdotally, happened? Then we would have rational decision-making without prejudging the outcome. By contrast to those regs, I view the Department of Transportation's change in the hours of service rule very differently. Based on my admittedly limited knowledge, this suspension was not proposed because of COVID and cannot be justified by COVID. It was the product of successful lobbying by trucking companies who simply wanted to have their drivers spend more time behind the wheel. It was started by an NPRM in August of 2019, before there was any indication of COVID. It was finalized in March of 2020, and COVID became a justification. But it was not limited to truck drivers transporting medical supplies, testing equipment, hand sanitizers, and disinfectants. It was part of the general Trump administration deregulatory agenda. It just happened that the final rule emerged at the same time as COVID. As above, I have a preference for how review of that change should come out. I think it's dangerous, not only for the truck drivers, but for all drivers and their passengers on interstate highways on which these trucks travel. But again, that decision should be based on actual data. Should the data indicate, the Biden administration could revert to the pre-Trump rule regarding hours of service, and at the same time, carve out an exception for the delivery of vaccines if that proves to be appropriate and or necessary. Exceptions can be made and possibly should be made, but we should not justify a wholesale revision on grounds that are palpably not accurate. I will not belabor my adverse reaction to the many steps taken by OSHA and EPA. EPA, the agency so many loved to hate during Democratic administrations, suspending requirements for reporting emissions and discharges, and easing enforcement of noncompliance with applicable permits, regulations, and statutes. Many of these measures can be read and are read electronically. No human beings need to participate. Do I expect that approach will continue after the pandemic or even during the remainder of the pandemic? I would think it unlikely. But again, I do not have a working crystal ball. I do want to emphasize what Karen was saying in the, do we let these exemptions, suspensions, waivers go through, or do we slap back on our regulations? She said, probably not, but then she said, we should do spot checks. That piece I endorse. That piece I encourage. Let's not do one or the other without the necessary analysis of both the costs and the benefits of this real experiment. So let me close here. Perhaps Karen would like to respond or chime in with some other suggestions or whatever, but thank you.
Yes, thank you, Sally. I really appreciate your perspective. I truly do. And I think, you know, one of the things I'd just like to say before we go back to Daniel for questions is, you know, where I think my members get frustrated with when we start talking about the benefits of the regulation is in this day and age. I mean, if you look, one of the things that under the Trump administration wasn't just the two for one, which I personally support, because I feel like it got rid of a lot of regulatory underbrush, if you will. I mean, all regulations are not the same. Some have been on the books for forever and nobody even knew they existed, and probably including some of the people at the agencies charged with enforcing them. And if they're not being enforced and haven't been enforced in decades, then I think the answer is, can we get them removed from the books so that we can, you know, not some errant inspector one day use it against some business owner or regulated entity they don't particularly like, and it looks like a good sword at the time. I mean, I just think that that was a good, I mean, overall, we obviously supported that effort, but also the sky hasn't fallen since the size of the Federal Register has fallen. I mean, if you look at the Federal Register under the last 4 years of the Trump administration, I mean, it's paper thin, and I refreshingly so, quite frankly, because when it comes to benefits, I feel like we really have reached a point on so many of our issues, and I'm not saying all, new issues present every day, and there is going to be a need for regulatory intervention in order to prohibit bad actors. But, what you find, let's, you know, as Sally mentioned, you know, the EPA is not something that my members are huge fans of as an agency, but, you know, the Obama administration with their Clean Air Act, rule that they had put forward that really would have redesigned the entire, you know, energy economy, they used as benefits, not just the benefits to America and the United States, but the benefits to the world. And my goodness, I mean, but the costs were just for, you know, the US. And so we need to do apples to apples comparisons. And I feel like so often now with some of these statutes that have been on the books for forever, where new regulatory proposals are coming out, we're trying to reach some heightened, you know, platinum standard and of regulation. And that's when you really do need to weigh it strictly with the cost. I mean, I think you should always do a cost benefit analysis. I don't mean to say not to do that, but I mean, that's where I start thinking, you know, what are we trying to do here? Like, how much are we really getting out of this? Is the juice worth the squeeze, as a colleague of mine likes to say? I also would just finally say that in response to Sally's note that, you know, regulations are not necessarily a drag on the economy. Honestly, NFIB's research, National Federation of Independent Business, with which I'm affiliated, was pretty consistent and clear that they were. I mean, as soon as Obama lost, and that even before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was, you know, really being seriously considered, you saw small business owners sighing a great sigh of relief. And one of their top three issues, regulations, started going down as a top issue. Many of the regulations, quite frankly, that Obama was putting forward were really targeting the big businesses. But because they were coming so fast and furious, my members never knew what was going to hit them next. And as a result, it really did paralyze them. I just saw it firsthand, and I also saw it in the data. So I would argue against that. I think it does have, if nothing else, I saw it. It impacted the small business owners I represent and their decisions. And I think it really, when they knew that the day of gotcha, you know, regulation was over, at least for a period, it helped them feel more comfortable, you know, putting back into the economy the cash that they've been sitting on. So those would be my reactions.
Well, I appreciate that, Karen. And I am not in any way impugning the subjective response of your members to a questionnaire, you know, what's your greatest concern, what's your greatest threat? And I know that consistently small business has said it doesn't like regulations and it doesn't like paperwork. And actually I'm far more sympathetic to the latter than to the former. But let me just address a couple of points, because you put a lot in there. I'd like to unpack it a little bit. You talked about there might be secret regs and somebody is going to come in there and enforce something that they don't even know about and the company doesn't know about and the agency has forgotten is on the books. That is gotcha. And that is not a common or even an occurring practice. Every president for the last 20 years, 30 years, has had a policy in place that does a regulatory look back that says if there's something there that doesn't make sense, that hasn't been enforced for years, that hasn't been useful, hasn't provided benefits, then tell us about it and we will get rid of it. And the Obama administration claimed billions of dollars in rollbacks well before Trump. And I have to say, even during the Clinton administration, we found lots of things. And the way we found them was by people saying, what's this? Where did it come from? What's it doing here? And that is a wholly legitimate thing to do, to complain about a specific regulation. But after cleaning the books and re-cleaning the books and re-cleaning the books over the course of Clinton, let's start with Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush and Clinton and W. Bush and Obama, the request for the regulated entities to say, what bothers you, has been in place, and those have not been enforced or played gotcha with people. And this was the crux of Al Gore's. I know you probably didn't remember Al Gore, but he had a reinvention program. And that was the major component for any of the agencies that do inspections. Don't go in there and say, uh-oh, you don't have the sign. Hang the sign up yourself. If the guy tears it down, that's another matter. But don't find somebody because they don't have the requisite sign in place. And that's been the policy, and that's been the practice for the last 4 years. We can talk about co-benefits, and whether you actually picked on another point, whether it's domestic or worldwide. We could talk about the discount rate. We can talk about co-benefits and direct costs. But let me just sort of end by saying that the one thing you said that concerns me is when you said, we don't need any more regulations. The Federal Register is a thin volume of poetry now. It's just, you can lift it easily, whereas before it used to be a doorstop. You said, we don't need more regulations. I mean, maybe there's some things out there we should regulate. There are a lot of issues, some of which were manifest during this pandemic. I would note that the Obama administration had a regulation regarding nursing homes, and it was one of the first that Trump killed. And you know, and I know, that nursing homes have been the source or the site of a number of the deaths of people, because very simple, straightforward, health-based regulations were eliminated. That's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about you gotta look at the benefits. That's past. For the future, we haven't stopped inventing. We haven't stopped discovering. Think of drones. Think of V2V cars, for example, just within transportation. Two huge issues. Drones, do they interfere with low-flying airplanes? Do they interfere with helicopter services? Do they invade the privacy of your backyard when they're coming and dropping their packages? Do they have cameras attached? And what does that mean? V2V, what are we talking about when we talk about automated cars? Wouldn't you want some sentient intelligence to think about the rules of the road, pun intended, to figure out how we go forward, what we think about with these new discoveries? I don't think the time for rest, the time for quiescence on the regulatory front is really here, as long as we keep living, discovering, innovating, pushing, and trying to enhance our quality of life.
Thanks, Hal. Let me jump in at this point. We're at the 40-minute mark. We got 20 minutes reserved at the end for audience questions. I think it's a good transition point. Obviously, we've had a robust and provocative discussion so far. I think it's been terrific. And let me ask Colton if we have questions in the queue from the audience. If so, I'll defer to those. If not, I can jump in with a few questions of my own.
We don't have any questions at the moment. Daniel, you can proceed with your questions.
Thanks. I guess one of the questions I have to start with is a question about regulatory uncertainty. I mean, Karen, I think you got to this issue somewhat in your discussion of, you know, what was happening with the economy by the end of the Obama administration and things that happened around the transition to the next administration. I mean, regulatory uncertainty is a key issue, and the pandemic environment added a whole new layer of uncertainty to the environment for everyone. And to some extent, I think it's fair to say that the move to looking at waivers and suspensions of regulations or their enforcement at the federal or state level helped to address some of that uncertainty. Could either one of you offer some more thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to say, you know, we just, NFIB just released some its latest study today showing that one in four businesses are likely to close their doors if the economic conditions remain the way they are for six more months. And we are going to lose millions of businesses as a result of this pandemic. And I guess what I would say is the uncertainty, right now, small business owners are just trying to have cash to stay alive. Like they're really at the basics of what they're trying to accomplish here. You know, do I have the cash flow to pay my employees, to pay my rent, to pay for my family to eat? And then when we go beyond that, it's, you know, okay, how do I get my doors open? How do I get the PPE I need? How do I make my place safe so that employees and customers feel comfortable working here? What they don't need on top of that is, How much longer do I have to wait till some OSHA inspector or whoever comes in here and starts trying to, honestly play gotcha? If it's a conversation, that's one thing. One of the things I meant to mention in my comments going on is, you know, a lot of laws were passed at the beginning of this pandemic, including one that required employers to provide family leave to their employees that had COVID or had people with COVID in it, and then they get a tax credit for doing so. And there were a lot of rules attendant to that. And in numerous conversations with DOL officials, learned, you know, they were calling, they were hearing from employees that were not happy with what their employer was doing. They would call the employer, explain things to them. The employer was like, oh, I didn't understand that about the rule. I'll start doing that now. Problem solved. Much more cooperative relationship. I just think as we're pulling out of this, one of the things that can help with uncertainty is not feeling like it's going to immediately be a boot on the back of the neck after they get through all of the other things that are much more pressing. Again, money and, you know, just getting the business operating again from government officials. If they can have the notion that there's not going to be a bunch of new regs coming down the pike immediately, and also that the enforcement is going to be, you know, bad actors need to be punished. And, you know, if they're willfully disregarding regulations that they know about, I'm not defending those people. I'm defending people that are trying to do the right thing and are just trying to keep their head above water.
Well, I appreciate that, Karen. And I actually agree with you. I think it is extraordinarily troubling that millions of small businesses are closing. that they cannot make ends meet. I think that is horrific. I think some of them survive because of what Congress was able to do earlier in the year. Somebody should explain why Congress has not been acting in the last several months to ensure that those who should be receiving money are getting it. And I would submit that the reason many of these small businesses are closing is the lack of funds, not some OSHA inspector coming by unannounced and acting like a bull in a china shop. The need for small businesses to have funds, whether to pay their employees or to protect themselves and enable themselves to keep going, is real. That is the elephant in the room. The regulations are less of a factor than the absence of any money to keep them going. I join you in urging the Congress to do something already instead of playing games up there. But I think to say that it's the regulations and the behavior of regulators, I think it's a distraction from the real issue. How do we get meaningful amounts of money into the pockets of those who should be getting it? Look at where the first tranche of money went, to big businesses, under the guise of, well, we have lots of little shops all over the place. That wasn't what it was intended to be. That's the maladministration of the earlier program. And any effort to supervise that, to oversee it, to comment on it, was destroyed by the Trump administration. The firing of inspectors general and other kinds of things that were put into the statute to ensure that your members got what they should have gotten. I don't disagree with you. And on uncertainty, I think uncertainty is critically important. To go back to Daniel's question. But I think the on again, off again is one of the factors that we've lived with for the last decade or two. And I think that's very troublesome. But I wouldn't say now's the time to start worrying about it. There's also the uncertainty on the benefits side and whether people can expect protection. Whether people in nursing homes who were told that they were going to be protected and then were told, no, we're not. That's uncertainty too.
Thanks, Tebow. Let me jump in. We're coming up close to the 10-minute mark left now. So, Colton, are there any more audience questions yet?
We don't have any, but I'm going to make an announcement. If you have joined via Zoom, please click the raise your hand button to ask your question. If you joined via phone, please enter star and then 9 on your telephone keypad to raise your hand. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt. Once you hear the prompt, please state your name and affiliation and then ask your question. We will answer all questions in the order in which they are received. Daniel, thanks. Back to you.
Thanks. I'll jump in with a question then to follow up on some of this discussion. But if we get audience questions, by all means, feel free to jump in, Colton. I'd like to pick up on the thread that we just left. And, you know, it struck me when Sally, you were talking about the question of benefits and their consideration early on, that one of the issues we're dealing with in the pandemic period is that the benefit costs analyses, the benefit cost calculations that ran out and produced results, produced conclusions in the pre-pandemic period were in large part upset, you know, in many cases, by the changing circumstances of the realizability of benefits and the actuality of costs in the pandemic period. And I think it's fair to say that that kind of upsetting of pre-pandemic calculations is going to continue as long as the pandemic does. So I want to see if I can get your thoughts quickly, both of you, on whether there's some consensus that in light of that, we do need to have some attention to flexibility in enforcement of the pre-existing results of those calculations in light of how things might be new now. Karen, you want to start with that? Sally? Either one of you, jump in.
No, that's fine. I would agree. I think that back to what I was saying earlier, I think as we pull out of this, we really do need to do a hard look. I know Sally mentioned just now about how agencies are, you know, each agency does the regulatory look back. Quite frankly, our experience with that is they haven't done the kind of rigorous look back that we think Section 610 of the Reg Reform Act requires. But now we do have some regs that, you know, we've been dealing with. And before they come back on the books, I think there just needs, let's at least start with those and do a meaningful review and look at again, costs and benefits of those and whether any adjustments need to be made. I think that I understand that the people that work in the agencies are hardworking and work hard. I know many people that do work there and they are not, you know, doing the 8-to-5 deal. I mean, they're 9-to-5. I mean, they are working, you know, hard and getting as much out as they can. But at the same point, before we start adding on new stuff, let's look at especially the ones that we've just have immediate experience with and give a meaningful review too, and see really, you know, what are the benefits of keeping this regulation or reinstating it? I think that analysis, we're at a perfect time to do it. And I just hope the agencies, especially those that have had these waivers, will do that thoughtful review.
Sally, some more thoughts on that?
But the only, I don't disagree with Karen about the need to examine what we do before we do it. And I guess the only thing that I would add to that is that the cost-benefit analysis has never been precise. This is in response to Daniel's comment that some things maybe didn't happen or weren't realized. So that, for example, on the hours of service rule, there's a lot fewer people on the highways, or at least there were in the spring. People didn't travel, at least in some areas of the country. They stayed home. And so the benefits and the costs were of a different model. Should information be updated? Absolutely. Should we think that only the benefits have disappeared? In many instances, the costs have been greatly diminished as well. And so a fresh look would be appropriate. And that was what I was calling for in my view about what a Biden administration should do.
Thanks. Let me offer another question. It struck me for some time that what has happened during the pandemic period has in some cases accelerated transitions of work, of education, of home life that were already in place. I'm thinking of things like telework, telemedicine, teleeducation. And I'm wondering if either of you have thoughts on how continuances of suspensions and waivers or just otherwise new directions in regulatory policy could help to support kind of the good impulse that this unfortunate pandemic has given us to move forward in the evolution of those practices.
Do you mind, Sally? I one thing in particular I wanted to note on this one. So the telework has been interesting, and I really think, and I know Department of Labor has done a little work on this, but I think more is needed moving forward. It might be time to relook at some of the reporting, especially for the non-exempt overtime employees and how that is monitored by employers in light of the new telework situation. I know for, and I told the department, and they did through FAQs, but I feel like, you know, we need maybe a more fleshing out of this. I think there needs to be some consideration of what is required of employers to make sure that time's being properly recorded, but that they're not being overburdened in doing that, quite frankly, because if you're not in the same physical location, it is just harder to know what your when your employees are working and when they are not. I felt that the agency did a nice balance in the FAQs they put out, but I mean, if that is something where you might actually want to have a more formal rulemaking process to formalize a lot of that.
Sally?
I think that there's a mixed track record on the teleworking and the teleeducation phenomenon, and I think we'll be studying it for years to come. As a professor, all of my classes for the end of the spring semester and all fall semester were on Zoom, and it was different. Was it better in some respects? Was it worse in some respects? How does it play out? I think that's something we really don't know. And I think that will be the subject of a number of studies, some underwritten by the government, many not.
Thanks. Colton, any more questions from the audience yet?
We don't have any.
Okay.
Daniel, we should probably proceed to closing remarks.
Sure. Let me ask then Karen to Sally to offer your closing remarks. Why don't we start with Sally this time?
Well, I think my views have been given a fair airing. I hope that some of my thoughts will be taken constructively, and I very much appreciate the opportunity by the Federal Society to invite and listen to different voices and different views. And as always, I'm just delighted to be with Karen and Daniel, who I have enormous respect, even if we differ on some points.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Sally and Daniel. I enjoy both of you all. And Sally, I love, this is one of the things I love about the Federalist Society, is I love getting to go back and forth with someone as knowledgeable and honestly who I've just, I mean, your career in this area is second to none. And you've done a lot to move it forward, honestly, for, you know, small businesses and all of us. I mean, and I appreciate that. I think, you know, again, I do think that this pandemic has taught us that it doesn't hurt to go back and look and see what's on the books and what needs to be fixed and do that more often than trying to create, you know, honestly, new regulations. I really encourage the new administration to use the lessons learned here and see what requirements might be able to be modified or simplified as a result of the experience we've had over the last year. And then, as Sally indicated, I definitely think when it comes to telework and teleeducation and all those sorts of things, you know, further study is needed so that we can figure out what's working and what isn't, because I do think that is the future. Pandemic brought us there a lot quicker than I think a lot of us were ready to experience. But I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks, Daniel, so much for moderating us.
No, you're welcome. Thanks to you both. And thanks to our audience members for tuning in. I hope it's been an informative and thought-provoking experience for you, and it will help you in your practice and your thinking going forward. Colton?
I just want to echo everything that has been said. Thank you, Karen, Sally, and Daniel, for taking the time today and for the insightful discussion. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. If you join late, this discussion will be posted as a podcast next week. Thank you for joining us. This concludes today's call.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.